Welcome to Antitrust Code by Conquences. Conquences is the leading antitrust database with over 40,000 articles on competition law. Conquences is also the largest network of antitrust experts with lawyers, economists, enforcers, and academics in 85 countries. By listening to this podcast, you will learn the fundamentals of competition law and hear about the latest antitrust news. Thanks to our guests, the best experts in the antitrust world.
Bonsoir. Bonsoir à tous. Hello. Thank you. I'm being told that we should start now. We are already late. So we have until what time in this beautiful place? We have to leave at 11, so we should start now. Thank you for being here tonight. It's Concurrence 20 years birthday today, and I'm very pleased that you're all there. We could have been more, but we wanted to be in Paris, in the Eiffel Tower. So 180 persons, we are fully booked today. Thank you for being here. I'd like to a short story. I just come back from vacation. And thank you. And I was over there. So I was in a mountain, the Southern Alps, called Queyras, and I was hiking in the snow. And while I was hiking, climbing this little peak, I thought, what is common between this hike in the mountain and Concurrence story? And there is a lot of connection to be made between this journey in the mountain and the journey of Concurrence. It's a story of hard work, a lot of preparation, some failures, a lot of successes. Most importantly, it's a story of a group of people. That's what I'm going to mention. Any journey starts with a dream. The dream I had was to create a journal with a group of people. That's a basic thing of Concurrence. A journal, people, that are DNA. No, it's not a startup, there is no seed money, there is no financial backer, no business angel, just the idea of a journal and a group of people. But for this journey, I also had a guide, and this guide was, and still is, Laurent Sido. And Laurent is for you, Laurent is over there. So I had my dream, I had my guide, and where did it start and when? We are in Paris in 2004, and I have three jobs. I'm working day and night in a big law firm, law factory, and also I give some classes at university, and I spend a lot of my weekends vacation writing papers for journals. But all inside me, I'm not fully satisfied. As many of you, sometimes we have doubt what we're doing. And I had some doubt, but I didn't know what to do. And that night, I had a dream. And the dream was to create a journal. So in the morning of this dream, I went to my little coffee in Paris, in Le Marais, Paris Beaubourg. And some of you may know this place. It's nice. Coffee is still there. And I write down all my dream. I put flesh on the bone. That was a morning in September. And this cafe become Concurrence Laboratory, Concurrence Lab. And I start to plan our journey. So the first thing we wanted to reach were the French summits, which were, still are, universities, Panthéon, Sorbonne, Assas, other universities. Also, we wanted to reach out to the competition authority, and of course, to the Supreme Court. And in 3 months, we did it. Thanks to Laurence, she gathered an exceptional lineup of professors from university, from France, but Belgium, Switzerland, and Germany. Bruno Lasserre, then competition president of the Competition Authority, who's here with us tonight, wrote one of the first papers in the journal, and also Guy Canivet, then president of the Cour de Cassation, opens the door of the court where we had our first conference, and was December 1st, 2004. So we decided to be more ambitious, and we wanted to climb other summits, which were EU summits, obviously. We wanted to reach out to the Commission and to the Court of Justice. This time, it took us 5 years. But in 5 years, we had Commissioner Almunia, then Commissioner of Competition Policy, who came 5 years in a row to the conference, New Frontiers of Interest. And we also had Judge Mark van der Woude, who came to the conference and also wrote papers. It took us 5 years, and then we thought, we were still looking to the West, 2010, we're looking to America. And for launching on the US market, we had another guide, Frédéric Genis. He's also over there. And with Frédéric, we wanted to climb the US summits. The first one was New York, with New York University, obviously. And in New York, Frédéric introduced me to Alana Fox, Harry First, and we launched another event. And then we went to Washington, D.C., and in D.C., we met with Bill Kovacic, George Washington Law, that's the U.S. summit. So we have an office now in New York with five people. Ariel cannot be there today, is the director of this office. Then came 2015, and we're looking now to the East, the U.K. We are before Brexit. And thanks God, before Brexit. And for this other journey, we have another guide. And this one was Richard Wish. And with Richard Wish, we wanted to climb UK Summit or London Summit, which are for us King's College London and also UCL London, where we have now two annual conferences still going down on. And Fanny, that I'm going to introduce to Fanny later on, she's a director of the London office. So what happened between 2015 and today? We went to other cities, other summits, Singapore, Hong Kong, Warsaw, Düsseldorf, Milano, Brazil this year, Mexico, Palo Alto, and next year, San Francisco. So that's the story in 2 minutes, the journey of concurrence in 5 minutes. But what did we learn about this journey? We learned three things. First thing we learned, reach for excellence. Just give you a number. This is Concurrence Journal, you recognize that. We publish only 1/3 of the article we receive. All the other articles, they might be published but somewhere else. So a scientific committee, led by Laurence, is very strict, very demanding, and we publish the best papers. For the events, we have done more than 600 events, and each time we reach out to the most sought-after speakers. Olivier, who's here tonight, Andreas, Margaret, Emmanuel. And those conferences, so we don't limit ourselves to do the best speakers. We do a lot of work, small details that the team led by Yasmin do. We do video, we do transcribe, we do key syntheses. But why do we do that? Because we know that you want excellent speaker, you want excellent papers. So we've been working in the last 20 years with the best universities, George Washington, King's College, NYU, Toulouse, but also OECD, and we have a lot of OECD representatives today. We've also been working with top-tier law firms and economic consultancies in the last 20 years, so thank you for the support of our partners. But we also learned something else from this journey. Strive for innovation. Frankly, we are a small company. We're international, but we are only 40 people, and without innovation, we will not be where we are now. Just one example for the event, the Antitrust Writing Awards. It is the sole competition about antitrust papers, and we, Concurrence, deliver the awards to authors wherever they publish, not only Concurrence, obviously, and we do that because we don't fear competition. The built-in. The bulletin, it's every week you can have authors writing, but you're also a one-stop shop for 85 countries or jurisdiction. Every week we go over 85 country jurisdiction and we publish their press release in addition to article. For books, the book we are most proud of is a dictionary. The Global Commission Dictionary with Bill and Richard and others is free online dictionary. More than 2 million visits since inception. And the mélange, you know what is mélange? Mélange in French, festschrift in German, and in USA, they didn't know about that. So we were the first publisher to introduce mélange, or festschrift, tribute in the USA, and we've done it for Alana Fox, Ovenkamp, of course, Bill Kovacic. And the third thing, and last thing we learn, is engage with the community. The community is first, authors and speakers, 7,500 of them have contributed to Concurrence Project. The community is much larger to speakers and authors, readers. 40,000 readers in 100 countries. Tonight, we are gathered as the antitrust community. Together, we make this community alive by writing, speaking, creating opportunities to meet like tonight. Sometimes we criticize each other, or lawyers criticize each lawyer. That is fair game. But that is all together the community. And our mission at Concurrence is really connecting antitrust people. That is our mission, our motto. And to just to tell, when we pick this mission motto, we thought two words would be enough. Connecting antitrust makes sense. But we wanted to add the word people because we believe that the community is made of actual people. So that's our mission. But the team is also the other part of the community. And tonight, I want to mention that I mentioned already the guide, Laurence, Frédéric, Richard, Bill. But you know, when you're doing a journey, high climb, high peak, you need Sherpas. So we had Sherpas. And the first Sherpa to come was Fanny. Fanny is here. Thank you, Fanny. You're there. And as I mentioned, she is now the director of the London office. She's also the chief editor of the journal. And the second Sherpa to come is Edouard Verté. He came back from Switzerland to start a job, an opportunity with Concurrence. And now he's a chief innovation officer, but most importantly, the Paris director. Okay, so they were the Sherpas, and I'm very pleased to announce today that as of January the 1st, they are my partners in Concurrence. So you see the next generation of leaders. There will be more to come. In the coming years, we will appoint new partners in the team between managers and other people. So that's the new generation. Sorry, that's too fast. That's the next one for Olivier. So I wanted to say thank you to all of you coming tonight, but also to the Concurrence team. They are all over you. They have a red tag or a pink tab. So don't be shy. Exchange with them, communicate with them. We are here to discuss with you, to have your feedback, to have new ideas for new conferences or new papers. And a last word. As you can see tonight, we are flying high, 57 meters above ground in the Eiffel Tower. But remember, the peak is over there, 300 meters, okay? So we still have a long journey to go, or the peaks or the summit to climb, and I wish to do this together, all together with you next year and the coming years. Thank you very much. Thank you. And now, we're going to have a fireside chat with Olivier and Kushita. If Olivier and Kushita want to join here on the podium, are they here?
Yes, I think
yeah,
they're
here. Thank you.
Before Kushita talks, there's first of all, to the 20 years of Concurrence. And the thing I really like with Concurrence is that it's a publication in English that is not called competition. So you add to the rayonnement de la culture française, Nicolas.
Nicolas, thank you so much for this honor to interview Olivier. This has been such an excellent product. I've been covering competition law for about 8 years now. I was a financial journalist in another life. I lived in Brussels for 4 years, and I have to say that I have never seen a product like this before. So thank you so much, and I'm not saying that just because you invited me. I'm saying that because you published my articles in Concurrences. I am the lead correspondent for antitrust in the United States for MLEX. Less of me, more of Olivier. We've got a tightly curated event for about 20 minutes, and I've got 6 or 7 questions for Olivier. So let's just get cracking, shall we? So Let's just start with a soft one, Olivier. Walk us through how competition policy landscape has evolved over the past 20 years. 20 years, obviously, because it's the 20th anniversary of Concurrences. What lessons have you learned, or let's say, what lessons have enforcers learned? And
thank you.
Your track record.
Our track record. In Europe, the landscapes has changed incredibly in the last 20 years. I mean, think that 20 years ago, we were in a world in which companies were notifying their agreements in Brussels to colleagues that were never getting out of their office and were rubber stamping the notifications they were presented with. We had virtually no case on cartels. We actually started to have a crackdown on cartels in 2001-2002, so about 20 years ago. So the world was really different. I had drafted some years ago with friends the notice on market definition, in which there is not a single word, the 1997 notice, on digital markets. And so if you think about it, the world has changed around us, and antitrust enforcement has changed as well. It has become a much more agile enforcement, much more cooperative, certainly in Europe, among the Commission and national competition authorities. We have moved from a world that was commission-centric to a world in which the decentralization of the application of competition law in Europe has really worked. 90%, 90, of all decisions under the treaty, under the competition chapter of the treaty, have been adopted by national competition authorities, not by the Commission, in the last 20 years. We have moved gradually and increasingly over the last years towards innovation theories of harm, both in antitrust and in mergers. Innovation shapes more and more the competitiveness, and the time lag has shrunk between the time an innovation occurs and the time it changes fundamentally a market. It used to be 10 years. Now it's a matter of months. So really everything has changed. And I think somebody that would have fell asleep in 2003 or 4 and would wake up now and would go to the office in any competition authority in Europe would have difficulties to cope.
Thanks, Olivier. And here come the hard questions. The people at the back are going to want to listen to these ones. Let's talk about Side Dish Gate. So again, in a nutshell, I'd like you to address the hot button topic of the great US-EU antitrust divide. Do you agree that the Europeans are from Venus and the Americans are from Mars, and whether there really is a focus on the consumer welfare standard versus a broader approach to corporate consolidation?
Well, let me quote a very famous antitrust author, Paul McCartney. Venus and Mars are all right tonight. The truth is, for a number of years, it's fair to say that the European Commission and the colleagues in the ECN felt a bit alone holding the flag of tough competition enforcement. We were criticized in the US for being too interventionist, both in antitrust and in mergers. And the least that can be said is that the various US administration were not interventionist, or at least not too interventionist, in those years. We can have a discussion about whether the European Commission was standing in the right place in terms of how relevant its enforcement was and is. We tried to go after what mattered and not after the rest, because we have to make choices because we have scarce resources. But certainly in tech, I think we made a difference. And what we see for the last for 5 years is that the rest of the world, including the US, rejoins. So it's not completely strange that in the US there is a correction that you do not see in the EU, because the trajectory was different. The second reason why it's difficult to compare, frankly, is that our legal systems are completely different. In the US, when you're the administration, you need to signal to the judge the change in your enforcement policy, because in the end of the day, you will have to defend it to a judge. We take our decisions, and they are reviewed with an administrative law standard by judges. So that makes a complete difference, and that makes also a complete difference in terms of how we shape our guidelines, for example. We do not make declaratory guidelines. We make guidelines that wrap up years of enforcement practice and case law in order to try to cast a light on the future. In the US, you have to make declaratory guidelines because you have to signal judges throughout the countries, hey, that's my new policy. So I think it's really difficult to compare. The only thing that I can say is that we have, with this US administration, the best cooperation we have had for a long time.
I will not say who, but someone from a gatekeeper company told me a long time ago, well, actually not that long ago, that the European Commission is the judge, jury, and executioner. They're more worried about Brussels than they're about Washington, D.C. So anyway, we are going to talk about the DMA now. March 6th, today is the deadline. How can we not talk about the DMA? Okay, hot topic. Today is the deadline. What happens if companies are non-compliant? I guess there's been a lot of long-term critics of the GAFA companies throwing both confetti and invectives about how the compliance remedies proposed by the gatekeeper companies are not enough. Do you think the companies are compliant? That's question one. This is a three-part question, Olivia, bear with me. What happens next? And if there are cases of non-compliance, can we expect any cases now or in 6 months? Basically, how much patience are you going to show?
Okay. You know, we have moved from design to implementation. Implementation phase stops tonight at 2400, and enforcement starts tomorrow at 000. Will everybody be compliant? I don't know. We'll see tomorrow. Probably not, my guess. But you have various ways of being non-compliant. You have, I'm on my way to be compliant, but let's face it, I mean, the amount of things gatekeepers had to do in the last 6 months is simply gigantic. We know that. Most of them have been engaging with us in good faith. But, you know, you first have to understand exactly what it is the DMA requires you to do and prohibits you to do. If you haven't, when you have understood that, you have to rethink your business model. When you have rethought your business model, you need to adapt the coding and you need to adapt all the contractual and legal environment. It shouldn't be underestimated. So that not everybody is exactly there tomorrow morning, probably that's true. Different type of non-compliance is, I'm not compliant because I've been trying to game the system. I've been trying to put on the DMA a number of things that actually are not only not necessary for compliance, but are, I would dare to say, against the DMA spirit and letter. And I've been trying to put that in my public communication, and we'll see tomorrow whether in fact or not, on the shoulders of the DMA. Some of these attempts, well, you've seen some U-turns recently from some of the gamekeepers, because they decided in the end of the day that, okay, well, will we continue to accelerate and go to the wall? Maybe not, so we break. But you may see some cases like this tomorrow. If this is the case, you can expect swift and effective action. There is, for this type of behavior, there will not be any period de grâce.
Okay, I promised I wouldn't ask follow-up questions on your questions, but define SWIFT.
Ah. Well, you know, President Delors used to say you have the normal time, you have the administrative time. The administrative time is three times the normal time. And in this time, bear in mind, we had 15 member states. And he said that there is the European time, and the European time is 15 times the administrative time. No, SWIFT means you need still to respect the rights of defense. You need to make your case. But if it's only for me a matter of weeks rather than months, and a matter of months rather than years.
That's still faster than the US.
And that's faster than antitrust, and that's the reason why we have the DMA, actually.
Okay, I have to ask you a surprise question. Do you agree that corporate breakups are not in the DNA of the European Commission, or just broadly the Europeans? Do you agree that you first require an American judge to order a corporate breakup? And only then will there be enough political will to pursue that remedy here?
Well, these are two different questions. I agree on the first one and I disagree on the second. Let me move into this. It would be ridiculous to say that breakups is in the DMA, you know, if I take the opposite of your question, of the European Union, because we have the possibility to break up company ever since Regulation 1, 2003, so 20 years, and we never used it. So if it is in our DMA, it's well hidden. We never used it for many reasons. One is that if there is a cardinal principle in EU enforcement, this is the principle of proportionality. So breakup in the DMA, just like in Reg 1, is the last resort. I mean, you have tried everything. You have put numerous fines, and the same problem comes back. In the end of the day, maybe you will break up. The second issue is maybe if we have a first breakup case, we may choose to start with a European company rather than going and break up a company elsewhere in the world. No. So, and thirdly, if an American judge would break up a US company, I don't think that would change anything for us, because this would be a measure that would apply only on US soil. And if we wanted to follow up, we would have still to make our case by all legal standards respecting the principle of proportionality. So it's a different issue whether any US order by a judge would have extraterritorial effects. It may be the same way GDPR has extraterritorial effects, simply because the firm that is subject to that order could think that it doesn't make any business sense to have a different organization in the US and in the rest of the world. That may be. But for us as enforcers, it would be interesting, et cetera, et cetera, but that wouldn't change anything to our capacity or incapacity to break up a company in Europe.
I think I've got my headline for tomorrow. EU's Gerson says agency will break up European companies first. I'm kidding. I'm just trying to tease you. I'm doing yellow journalism here.
Well, you would not the first one to put words in my mouth that are not exactly what I said. So.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I should have seen you conflate DMA for DNA. So serves you right. Let's talk about mergers now. And Nicola, we might go slightly over time. I hope that's okay. It seems that with deals like Amazon and iRobot being blocked, the big GAFA companies, any move they make to expand or acquire rivals in the space, or let's say not rivals, but you know, adjacent companies in the space, is going to be thwarted by you and your team. Are there any deals possible for them? And under what circumstances?
Well, yes. I mean, And I have proof. We approved Google Fitbit. We were criticized for this. That's my best example, so I can't resist. We were criticized for this by even sister competition authorities, including the ACCC at the time, that had cleared the merger. That's my favorite. They cleared the merger and they say that our remedy is too soft. So the answer, the short answer is yes. Now, I mean, while you're a platform, but for me, and I know in legal terms it's not exactly true, but I'm sorry for the many lawyers in the room, I'm not one of them. But the analogy can be made with essential facility doctrines. So, I mean, if you are an ubiquitous platform you are a mandatory trading partner in order to, well, take, I'm sorry for, you're just in front of me, so I think of Microsoft. But I mean, it is true if you want to reach, to interface with a PC, you do not have much other possibilities than to go through a Microsoft product. So, and this is what we mean by gatekeeping. And of course, that gives you a number of special responsibilities. And actually, in the past, when it was about incumbents for very traditional markets in Europe, looping back to your previous question, we decided to unbundle. So I think it would be naive to say that it doesn't create a number of difficult issues that needs to be solved. And sometimes it's by a prohibition, although in Amazon iRobot, we didn't prohibit, they abandoned. And sometimes it's with remedies, and sometimes the case is not strong enough and it may be simply accepted. So I strongly believe that each case should be dealt with on its merits. And they're different because you need, when you make this analysis, that's one of the thorny issues with the DMA, you need to take into account that the DMA exists. Because in the end of the day, when you assess a merger, what you assess is the balance of probability of a given behavior in the future. So the bit on ability would not change, but the bit on incentive, you suddenly, the balance of incentive may be different, at least theoretically, with the DMA than it was before. And there, I think, this is where you need to go a bit more into detail. So that means, is the fact that the DMA exists and prohibits given behavior makes it less likely or rather unlikely that the a gatekeeper will enter into the said behavior? That depends. My take is, if you take sideloading, for example, very easy to detect. I mean, if the sideloading authorization of sideloading obligation is not respected, I will know within 3 minutes and I will have 2,000 complaints. Self-referencing, maybe the victims themselves will not detect it. It's very difficult to detect for an enforcer. So, now I come back to the short answer. No, there is room, of course, for mergers.
Have you found my questions soft or hardball so far? Sorry? Have you found my questions easy or hard so far?
Easy, so toughen, please.
Okay. Well, let's not go into the regulatory collusion topic that comes to mind. This has been a big shitstorm back in the US. I got reminded of that when you brought up the ACCC example. Anyway, we've got two main topics to go through. And Nicola, this is how I cheat. When you give me little time, in one question, I ask 5 questions. So you've spent some time as the deputy head of cartels, sort of in another life. And I think one of your less talked about achievements is this rejuvenation of cartel action. Fair bit of news over the past 6 months from both the European and the US side. So is this crackdown on cartels back in terms of international cooperation, or is this an EU-led revival? Hold on for my other questions. what kind of cases will we see? Are they all novel, or are these just old-fashioned cases dressed up in new clothes?
Well, when I came back to I left DigiComp as a director for Cartel, and I came back as director general 10 years after. And what I saw is that during 10 years, the commission, like most of the colleagues around the world, had simply been processing the stock of immunity application they had. And the result was that this stock was drying up. So and I was told many things, like you should repeal the damage directive, because this is what actually is the problem. I said, well, listen, I'm not so convinced, because when I look at what the US did, they have detribled. Have you seen a surge in immunity applications? No. And actually what I decided to do, I appointed a new director for cartels, Mrs. Jaspers, with one mission: build the pipeline of ex officio case back, which she did. And she started to make a number of downgrades on ex officio cases. Immediately, the number of immunity applications went back up. And since 2021, year after year, it is higher. And actually, every downgrade on an ex officio case, on average, brings back one immunity application, whether in the same sector or in a neighboring sector. So why would you confess if you don't risk to be detected? So enforcement, 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 ex officio, this is our motto. I think the US are trying to do the same. They have been leaders in areas like poaching agreements, in which we were not active. We're not quite active now on this. But that is true as well, that the type of mega world cartels that we used to have in the 90s and 20 years ago, we see less of them. And maybe because there are less of them, or because they are much, much more sophisticated.
You mentioned Maria Jaspers. If people in the audience haven't seen this, the first time ever the European Commission and the Department of Justice have come up with a joint 5.5-minute video asking for whistleblowers to come forward. I think it's pretty unprecedented for a video like that to be made. Anyway, here's the last question. And if we can have a little silence, because Olivier is going to announce a major secret.
I can do it the speaker's way. Order!
You just need a gavel. All right, this is the last question, and then we can all go back to our drinks. The European Parliament elections are approaching fast in June. What's the thinking that's taking place inside the Commission? What are the priorities for the next mandate? How will your directorate be affected? And just to tack on this other question, since you wanted to talk about industrial policy too, what do you think will be the priorities in industrial policy terms, and what sectors could benefit?
Okay, well, I don't think the fact that finally the European Union has come to term with the fact that it needs a European policy, like basically everybody else in the world, is a problem. And I don't think it is a problem for competition policy either. The issue, I mean, what I mean to say is that competition policy and industrial policy, in principles, are two long-term competitiveness policy. So they should go hand in hand. It becomes complicated with some type of industrial policies, like pick the winners or subsidize everybody at will, where indeed you have an issue of consistency with competition policy. But the best industrial policy for me is the industrial policy that uses competition processes. Look at the way we managed to cut by two the cost of windmills in Europe. It happened when we forced a systematic auction process on the auctioning of wind farms. In less than a year, the price were divided by two. And it's a win-win. You can, for the same cost for public finances and private finances, you can deploy double the number of windmills. So I think we will continue to have an industrial policy. I think competition policy should, to some extent, help it. Of course, in the area of state aids, what that is our small idiosyncrasy in Europe, so I will not expand on that, but I think we should help. But also in the area of mergers and cartels. Of course, mergers is the most complicated issue here because your margin is not so great. But if you look at our rate of intervention, it's pretty steady over the last 30 years. Out of 100 merger, we intervene in 5% of the cases, we prohibit in 0.5%. So that means that most of the time, either it's unproblematic, or there is a way to combine critical size and merger process on the preservation of effective competition. So in that respect as well, I don't think we would have a problem. Of course, I mean, in this country, I'm always given the example of Siemens Alstom. Well, in Siemens Alstom, it's very simple. I mean, these two companies came to see us and said, we need to merge to get critical size worldwide and resist the soon-to-come Chinese invasion in Europe. We prohibited, we're 5 years later. There is not one single Chinese train in Europe, and there will not be for a very long time. And Siemens and Alstom, guess what, are number one and two in the world. So we have two European champions, and competition, and innovation, and good prices for the customers. So that's the kind of industrial policy I like.
Touché. Okay, so 25 minutes, I think I pretty much managed the time well. Two takeaways, comply with the DMA. Olivier and his team are watching. And if you're a European company, be worried. Be very worried. I've got my two headlines for tomorrow. And you're giving me an interview after this, right? Because I have like 100 follow-up questions.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.